The court will hear United States v. Bong. We'll start with Mr. Lee.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Josh Lee from the Public Defender's Office for Mr. Troy Bong. There are a number of issues in this case, but unless the court steers me in a different direction, I'm going to start with the Armed Career Criminal Act issue. The question is whether Kansas aggravated robbery is a violent felony. And the state of Kansas has chosen to affix the label aggravated robbery to a broad range of criminal conduct that we wouldn't ordinarily consider aggravated robbery. And for that reason, it's not a violent felony. First, the court needs to address whether robbery by itself is a violent felony, and then whether the aggravation element makes it a violent felony. So let's start with simple robbery first. Simple robbery in Kansas is not a violent felony because the Kansas Supreme Court has explicitly held that it includes mere purse snatching. That's in the 1998 McKinney case. Now, this court addressed Kansas simple robbery recently in its Nicholas case, and Judge Bacharach, I know that you were on the panel there, and it said that simple robbery isn't a violent felony because it includes mere purse snatching. Now, Nicholas is unpublished, but it's persuasive because it correctly applies the Supreme Court's Curtis Johnson decision. Under Curtis Johnson, violent force is required to make an offense a violent felony under the force clause.
Let's back up just a minute. Gaining peaceable possession of property is not robbery, it's theft.
That's right, Your Honor, but the Kansas Supreme Court has said that purse snatching is not gaining peaceable possession of property. So what matters is not the abstraction that the Kansas Supreme Court uses in describing the offense, but the minimum real-world conduct that would constitute the offense.
Well, how about our Harris case?
Mm-hmm. Harris is
dealt with Colorado, but it doesn't appear to be much of a difference.
There is a difference if you look at the cases, and the difference is simple. Colorado robbery doesn't include mere purse snatching, and Kansas robbery does. And that is the distinction that this court drew in the recent Garcia case, where they divided up robbery offenses into two categories. And they said there's robbery offenses that require minimal force, such as purse snatching, that can constitute robbery, and then there are robbery offenses that require more than minimal force and more than just purse snatching. Colorado and New Mexico, and most robbery offenses, fall on the side of the line of requiring more force. Whereas Kansas robbery and a certain minority of other jurisdictions say that simple purse snatching without more can constitute robbery. So that distinguishes Kansas robbery.
Well, what is simple purse snatching? Grabbing it and ripping off somebody's shoulder or just lifting a wallet out of their pocket?
If they're just holding it and you take it out of their hands, that's enough. There doesn't have to be a struggle, that you don't have to break a strap. If you broke a strap on the purse or overcame a struggle, that would put the offense in the more violent category. But that's not what Kansas law is.
And what about the fact that there was no objection to the PSR?
So we have brought this claim on 2255.
I know you have, but of what significance is the fact that it was never objected to and it was clearly... predicate offenses were involved in the recitation in the PSR.
There's no significance to it for two separate reasons. Well, actually three. The first of which is that 2255 authorizes any constitutional claim and any claim that your sentence is above the statutory maximum. That's the claim we've got here. The second reason is...
Well, we're not above the statutory maximum here, are we?
We are about the statutory maximum because we're claiming that he was sentenced...
Oh, if it was... Okay.
Yeah, under the Armed Career
Well, you're disputing the admission in the PSR.
I don't think there was an admission. There was no objection to it.
Well,
that's true. But here's the second reason, is that the problem could be procedural default. That could be the problem. But procedural default is an affirmative defense that the government has never raised. And the reason it hasn't raised it goes to my third point, which is there was not a claim that simple robbery was not a valid predicate before the Samuel Johnson decision in 2015. Because Kansas simple robbery was a violent felony under the residual clause. So there was no valid objection at the time of sentencing. So that's why the government didn't raise procedural default, because there would have been cause and prejudice. So in addition to Nicholas and Garcia indicating that robbery offenses that cover mere purse snatching are not violent felonies, you also have decisions from the 1st, 6th, and 9th circuits that I've cited in my brief that hold the same thing. And there's no court of appeals that has held otherwise. Every circuit that's addressed this issue has held that robbery offenses that include mere purse snatching aren't violent felonies. So now let's go to the aggravation element. There are two means of satisfying the aggravation element. The first is if the defendant causes bodily harm, and the second is if the defendant is armed with a dangerous weapon. Now, the government has to show that both of those means would entail using violent force, but in fact, neither of them do. The first reason, the first means is causing bodily harm. Again, Kansas has chosen to define this element in a really unusual way. In the 2014 Frierson case, they said that even if you cause bodily harm negligently, that's enough to make it aggravated robbery. And in that case, what the defendant was trying to claim is, I should have gotten a lesser included offense instruction on battery, because aggravated robbery includes all of the elements of battery. And the Kansas Supreme Court said, no, you don't get a lesser included offense instruction because battery requires a mens rea element. It has to be harm caused intentionally or at least recklessly, whereas the harm element in aggravated robbery has no mens rea element. And the Supreme Court has told us, first in Leocal and then later reaffirmed in Voisin, that if you cause bodily harm negligently, it's not using violent force. So for that reason, the aggravation means of causing bodily harm doesn't get them there. So you don't even have to address the weapons one. But if you do, the second means, armed with a deadly weapon, doesn't entail using violent force, because merely possessing a weapon is enough. You don't have to use it. You don't have to brandish it. You don't have to tell the victim that it's there. The victim doesn't even have to know it's there. So this is from the Bugs case that I've cited in my briefs. And in that case, the defendant had a knife on him when he committed the robbery. But he didn't display the knife, didn't use it. The victim didn't know that the knife was there. And the Kansas Supreme Court said, that's aggravated robbery because you still had it. So merely possessing a weapon doesn't entail using violent force. And again, we have two courts of appeals that have addressed this issue. The First and the Ninth Circuit have addressed it and said that aggravated robbery offenses that cover mere purse snatchings plus possession of a dangerous weapon without more don't constitute violent felonies. And indeed, the government itself, in the First Circuit case, admitted in its briefing that mere possession of a weapon doesn't add anything else to it. And the reasoning behind both the First and the Ninth Circuit cases is that merely possessing a weapon entails a risk. It increases the risk of the offense. But you can't hold that it's a violent felony based on risk, because that's the residual clause. That's unconstitutional, and so you can't smuggle in the residual clause's risk analysis into the force clause, which is what the government's trying to do. So for those reasons, the court should hold that Kansas aggravated robbery is not a violent felony. Now, I've got a couple of minutes left. I want to talk briefly about this video. At trial, one of the police officers, Officer Thatcher, testified that there was no video of the incident that led to Mr. Bong's arrest. Now, Mr. Bong obtained a receipt from an official record keeper in Wichita that said, actually, We searched for your police department case number, and we found two videos. So he has plausibly alleged...
Well, did the federal public defender, when they took up this case, ever attempt to verify what was there?
We didn't.
Why not?
Because we have a receipt that shows that they are there.
Well, you don't have a receipt that shows what's on the video.
We don't. So
why didn't you go and look at it as part of your 2255 presentation?
Well, we've got this case on appeal, and we understood ourselves to be limited to the record developed in the district court. I don't think it would be appropriate to litigate factual issues.
Well, you could go back in on a motion for reconsideration and said you discovered new evidence.
That's what he did.
No. I mean, you could have, even though you had it on appeal.
I suppose that's true. I don't think it's required. I think that the appropriate remedy would be to remand to the district court.
See all the time you're wasting and the judge's time and everybody's time by making this argument when you could have gone and gotten it and then just went back to the district court on a motion to reconsider.
I'm not appointed to represent him in Kansas. I'm only appointed to represent him in the Tenth Circuit. So there's that reason as well. And I think it's the most ordinary thing in the world to say, we've made plausible allegations, the district court threw them out, we're coming here on appeal, and to tell the district court we need a hearing on this.
Did you have that before the district court? Did they have the receipt?
Yes, the receipt was before the district court, and it's in the record as an attachment to Mr. Bong's second pro se plea.
Okay.
Because the existence or not of the video evidence is material, the court should remand also on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim and on the Brady claim.
Well, let me, I'm sorry, because I know you're trying to save time for rebuttal, but on the Brady claim, I get it. On the ineffective assistance claim, I'm not quite sold. Let's say Mr. Thatcher is a big fat liar about whether or not Mr. Bong was acting suspicious. And let's even give you all of that. There's a couple of questions. One is, the other officer, True Bong or whatever his name is, I forget, there's no allegation that he lacks credibility, right?
No, there is, because we have witnesses who would contradict that.
You have no direct witnesses to contradict that.
They contradict what?
So we have witnesses who talk about Jeremy Fisher possessing the gun.
Well, that was before.
Right. That's
okay.
That's
just
true.
Dropped
that's
it
true.
Okay.
Spot.
Okay.
On.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that's what I wanted to get at. So the other officer is not okay. Thatcher sees says he sees it drop. And the other guy, is rolling around and he spots the gun, but your client's pro se brief, in his reply, your client says that the gun was right underneath him. So would you agree that it's pretty odd, even weird, that he, even if Mr. Fisher was owned the gun and bought it at his shop, maybe he gave it when he was going to Boomer's house, his drug house, maybe he gave it to Mr. Bong, to protect himself. But in any event, he drops him off and says, okay, I'm dropping you off at this corner. I know you're going to walk to your buddy's house. Well, why didn't he take him to his buddy's house? Okay, but I'll give you that. So, and then he's going to go to the Quick Trip, and he really never goes to the Quick Trip. And so then he stays there, and then he sees the car, the police car, and so he runs, and lo and behold, there's a scuffle, and right underneath where Bong is the gun. What a weird coincidence, even if this video shows that Thatcher was lying.
So I don't recall from the pro se pleadings that Mr. Bong alleged that it was underneath him, but I'll take that assumption. I'll take that assumption.
Right.
But I think that the problem is that the government can't explain the other evidence, which is all of these witnesses corroborating what Jeremy Fisher said, that he did have the gun.
But it didn't corroborate anything. It had it before. Sure, I bought the gun. It was my gun. And that what happened in between, nobody corroborated that.
There's a Kayla Burkholder who said that in the days after the offense, he was calling the police to say, I have this gun, this was my gun, I need it back.
Well, sure. His friend calls up and says, hey, that was my gun, that he didn't have that.
I think that he's made allegations sufficient to warrant an evidentiary hearing. We can guess about what the evidence would be, but as Justice Gorsuch has said, it's better to know on remand than to guess on appeal. And I think that's apt here. Thank you.
I notice that Justice Gorsuch gets quoted more and more. We'll hear for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Jared Magg, I'm an Assistant United States Attorney for the District of Kansas, and I represent the appellee in this case. Let me begin by being very candid with the Court. I realize I'm up against quite a bit of case law, and obviously,
speak up, please.
I'm sorry. I'm up against quite a bit of case law with this case, and Judge Bacharach, we could almost pick up where we left off in Nicholas' case. We had quite a spirited debate in that matter, and clearly the government has a very stalwart position on this particular issue. We firmly believe that robbery is a crime of violence, and I think we made our points as clear as we could in that case. We understand that Nicholas, while it is persuasive. It is not a published opinion, and that leads us into the reason as to why we're asking the court to at least take another look at this, because we do believe that there is some inherent contradiction with Harris, particularly with the issue of how they looked at robbery in Colorado vis-a-vis what the court looked at as far as robbery in Nicholas. And some of the inherent contradictions that exist between those two cases led us to argue here that Harris, as a published opinion, should have a little bit more persuasive value. And to back up a little bit to what we talked about previously in the Nicholas case, it does, if you deconstruct it, it does rely. McKinney is the case that the court ultimately relied on, that the panel relied on in that case. But McKinney, the point that they made in McKinney about the purse snatching otherwise being an offense for robbery was almost an aside. He was convicted. Remember, he did push the victim in that case. And the sort of aside was...
Well, the government said he pushed the victim. He denied it.
He denied it, right. And the court says, well, otherwise, even if he hadn't, it would have been convicted of robbery nonetheless. Our position is, in light of how the court viewed robbery, particularly in Harris, but more globally as the court looks at the issue of Castleman. And at least in Castleman, Justice Scalia talks about the fact, at least gives these sort of approaches to what is violence under Curtis Johnson. Grabbing being one of them. And so the issue becomes, okay, if purse snatching is not a crime of violence, but the Supreme Court has said grabbing does in the context. And I understand, grabbing may be of the person vis-a-vis the actual object itself. But this gets to Judge Kelly's position is or question on the issue of simply grabbing something from someone without their knowledge. That clearly is theft. And that's what the Kansas Supreme Court said in Aldershot. That's just theft. They didn't know about it. They call it the sneak thief. They didn't see it, they grabbed it and left. But in the context of someone who knows they're being assaulted and it is grabbed from them, our position, of course, then is that that still constitutes robbery because, as the court said, it is capable of. And I think that we sort of hone in on that the panel in Nicholas didn't give enough credit to capable of causing. And look, I appreciate that may be somewhat of a stretch. But it we do believe that Nicholas didn't give enough credit to the capable of aspect of Castleman. And I don't know that you can necessarily divorce the act of grabbing a purse from someone who knows they're being assaulted versus what the court said in Aldershot is when I grab the purse and I don't know I'm being assaulted. They indicate there is such a distinct line in Kansas because they say that violence exists when the person knows versus when they don't. Now, I understand the court in Garcia talks about the issue of violence. That is not the sine qua non of the issue. We know that. But nevertheless, we believe that there is sufficient evidence, or at least sufficient case law through Castleman, that the grabbing of the item from a person who knows they're being assaulted is sufficient to satisfy robbery under Kansas law. With respect to aggravated robbery, again,
Frank, I'm sorry. Before you move to the aggravator, can I ask you, in this, and I want to ask you about a case, and we did not cite it in Nicholas, is my recollection, and so you may or may not be familiar with it. State versus Warwick. Do you remember that one? Okay.
I apologize. I'm not
familiar
with
okay.
that case.
It we didn't cite it. Okay.
I can certainly do a 28-J letter if the court wishes.
Well, I'll tell you what my question is, and I'm not trying to force you to talk about a case that you may not be familiar with, but there the Kansas Supreme Court said, and I'm reading from it, the state may prove the crime of robbery or aggravated robbery without proving that the robber actually touched or applied force to the person of his victim. Thus, the crimes of battery and aggravated battery are not lesser included offenses of the crime of robbery or aggravated robbery. And so, you know, obviously my question is, well, if the Kansas Supreme Court said, and this was in 1982, that the state may prove robbery without proving even an actual touching, then that seems maybe even stronger than McKinney.
Unquestionably. But again, I think it gets back to the whether or not the court gave enough appreciation of the capable of aspect of Castleman and whether or not that... Now, granted, if that is the case and that is the holding and that is... And that case dealt specifically with that issue versus whether or not aggravated battery is just a simple lesser included offense under those circumstances, whether or not that's dicta in that case, I don't know.
Okay.
Again, we go back, even back as far as the 1800s and more, when the court very quickly said, look, robbery is violent. And that, again, we sort of get, when we take a step back and look at this from 30,000 feet, again, it's very hard for us to believe that robbery is not a crime of violence. We get that. And the courts are beginning to express some of the concern with that issue, as many of these crimes are no longer considered crimes of violence. And so when you sort of paint that patina across our argument, I think the court understands sort of where we're coming from. With respect to the aggravated robbery, we also understand we're up against quite a bit of case law. We're yet to find a case that really supports the government's position. Most of the circuits are following Parnell with respect to this. There isn't any question that Bugs does hold that mere possession. But again, our argument, and we appreciate the fact that this does come across as somewhat of a residual argument clause, but we nevertheless have cited some cases that use equals availability. If you have the weapon, it changes the construct of the robbery because you could use that eventually. And because of that fact, that entering, having a weapon when you are assaulting somebody changes it to aggravated robbery, does put it into the context of a crime of violence. But again, we fully understand that the case law really is up against us in that respect.
And Mr. Lee argued, he said in his 28-J letter that the aggravator statute, I think, is indivisible. Do you agree or disagree with that?
That the
aggravated robbery statute is indivisible. There's two components.
Right, there's two means to do it.
Okay.
Bodily harm.
And you agree that it means
bodily harm or with a weapon.
Right.
Yeah. It's not unlike the aggravated battery statute. If I could turn to the issue, I'd like to turn to the issue because, Judge Kelly, you raised sort of a good point with respect to this video. We've attempted to try to persuade defendant that we have definitive proof that this doesn't exist.
I'm sorry. Get closer.
The video in question. We've attempted to persuade the defendant because we have definitive proof that it doesn't exist. We have affidavits from the clerk's office indicating what occurred with that particular piece of paper, that why there was an error in those case numbers and what happened with those case numbers. We've attempted to do that to try to save the court some time, but we understand if the court wishes to send this back, and in fact, if it does go back for resentencing, this issue certainly could be resolved immediately because we have the affidavits to prove that this video just simply doesn't exist. And it brings into question, too, the obvious nature of that. Why would two officers put their entire life on the line and say that no video existed when it would be so clearly provable that a video existed by simply going to the car and looking for the actual camera? In fact, Mr. Bong was placed in the car. There was no testimony from him that, yeah, I saw a camera, because these cameras generally are quite large. And so there's no testimony from that. But we do have definitive proof that this doesn't exist. I would simply proffer to the court that is available upon remand under the circumstances, but I wanted to at least put that issue to
you. As far as the Brady claim, and as I understood the red brief, you're essentially, I totally understand what you're saying, Mr. Bang, but you're to us saying we concede, we agree that the Brady claim should be remanded.
Yeah, we're really in that context at this point, because we think this court really just doesn't sit to resolve a matter that it doesn't have enough information on. And we cannot present the court with the affidavits. We simply would just proffer to the court that we have them, and we're willing to present those to the district judge upon remand. So no, we're certainly in a position to concede to at least send the issue back. Whether or not he properly exhausted that issue or at least from a timeliness standpoint, the court didn't seem to think that it was timely. So there is that question as to whether or not, you know, when he found out, was that within 1 year. He certainly raised the issue early on at least in his reply brief, that counsel was ineffective for not trying to find this video. So it seems somewhat awkward that he would make the argument in the reply brief, but then come up with the receipt later and then try to say that he only learned about it when he got the receipt.
Well, on the timeliness issue, and I'm not trying to make an issue, I just want to make sure I know if it's an issue or not an issue. Mr. Lee's arguing that under Day versus McDonough, there was a technical violation of regarding the Brady claim as untimely. And so if you're conceding to us that it should be remanded, you're conceding it, but I want to make sure,
right,
because you're starting to intimate
that
it's not timely.
Yeah, and I don't want to necessarily chase this rabbit down that hole.
Okay.
But nevertheless, Day versus McDonough was at its inception. Here we have a situation on a reply. Whether or not Day versus McDonough goes so far as to include a situation where the timeliness is after he's already filed his initial petition, whether or not Day goes that far is, I think, a question to be resolved under those circumstances. And so I don't want to say necessarily that Day versus McDonough applies, but I don't think the court needs to reach the question.
Okay.
So to get to your other point. Judge, to be candid, the situation with him falling on the gun isn't weird, it's laughable, quite frankly. That goes to the prejudice issue as to whether or not he can overcome that prong of Strickland. And I think the court appreciates the fact that claim that he just happened to fall on the gun at the very place that Fisher supposedly dropped the gun is just absolutely implausible at its core. And so I think to try to extrapolate that as a reason to send it back to meet the prejudice prong and to say that the government cannot somehow refute some of these issues, I think goes to Judge Kelly's question. It is largely irrelevant because none of the individuals who would testify under that circumstance were there. They could certainly testify that Mr. Fisher may have bought the gun. They certainly may have testified that he may have transferred the gun, but none of them were there that night. And to the degree that Fisher did testify to all of these facts, that he bought the gun, again, he doesn't even remember necessarily who he bought it from. So it gets to the issue of what do these people actually add, which then gets to the larger issue of whether or not there should have been an evidentiary hearing. And again, that is sort of the sub-issue that he is attempting to raise here, as to why the court erred in not granting an evidentiary hearing. But we believe that it was certainly within the court's discretion to refuse that evidentiary hearing, largely because he just simply could not overcome the prejudice prong because of this argument alone. But, again, if you look at the transcript and you see what Fisher testified to and you see what Bong testified to, they all testify around this issue. Certainly Fisher gets up and testifies that he dumped the gun virtually, well, exactly at the spot that Bong lies down on, or that he's taken to the ground on. But he certainly testifies to the fact that he had bought the gun from someone, that he, again, discards the gun, that he was with them that night. So what these third parties bring to the equation, I think, is simply wasn't enough for the court to grant an evidentiary hearing in the circumstances, which goes to the larger issue of how counsel was not ineffective for failing to find the individuals to testify to this. Unless the court has questions, I'm exactly at the end of my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayer. Mr. Lee? Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you. I do want to comment to both counsel. I thought your briefs and your oral argument, as always, were excellent, and I appreciate Mr. Banks' candor in several of his arguments. This matter will be submitted.